Hi, I'm Ashley Nichols.
And I'm Shamara Arkey.
And I am Casey Boyd Swan.
We're podcasting from Northeast Ohio. This is the Growing Democracy Podcast, a space to amplify multiple forms of knowledge, demystify politics, policy, and governance, and foster equity-centered civic engagement.
Each episode, we invite a guest or two to talk about what it means to be civically engaged, how engagement can be leveraged to dismantle systems of oppression, and how to grow a socially just and equitable democracy.
Welcome to the show, and thanks for joining us. So I am very excited about folks being able to hear this episode, although it's taken a while for us to get moving along in production. But I think this was a fantastic episode from a number of standpoints and kind of different than other episodes that we've done. Not because we're talking about anti-Asian racism, which we have talked about before on the podcast, Shamara. But I think just because the way that the guest that we have on today kind of came to where she is was, for me, I think, a really interesting story.
Yeah. You know, as someone who has worked in community for almost 20 years, it was really interesting to hear her journey from, you know, volunteer to board member to staff member. So really thinking about our institutions, who's there, who they're serving, we really are able to hear a variety of perspectives in this episode.
Yeah. And it's funny because I think that our guest today was so focused on talking about the organization that she works for and all of the services that, you know, that are offered there, which it really was kind of, I don't know about you, but it kind of blew my mind how many different kind of, like, the depth and the breadth of services that were offered, that she was, it took a bit for us to kind of unravel her story about her journey. But once that happened, what you had mentioned was that she really left us with this amazing kind of sensation of a call to action that inspired me to think about how sometimes, right, things that you just do where you're trying to share your abilities with your community or with something that you're passionate about, that can also, you know, have a lasting and meaningful impact on your own life.
Yes, yes. And what I really enjoyed about this podcast, one thing that I enjoyed is learning about the depth and the breadth of services, but really understanding that as organizations and institutions that are here to serve community, there has to be an intentional, intersectional approach. Thinking about the folks who are being served through Asia Services in Action, as they arrive in the States, independent of how they got here or why they're here, they're going to need a variety of services. And shout out to Asia Inc. for making sure that they are very intentional around meeting those intersectional needs. And if they don't meet them through their own organization, making sure to connect folks from the community to other places that do. And like you said, Elaine really gave us a call to action. And I think speaking from her own intersectional identities and the intersectional identity of the organization, there are various ways that we as citizens, volunteers, community members, however we want to identify ourselves, to become active in the work of Asia Inc.
Yeah, absolutely. So for all of those many reasons, this is our preview of our episode today with Elaine Tsao.
All right. So thank you for joining us so much, Elaine. To get us started, we'd like for you just to introduce yourself and your work to our guests.
Sure. Hi, everyone. I am Elaine Tsao, and I have the honor and joy of leading an organization known as Asian Services in Action.
And give us a little bit more about your history, who you are, and how you kind of came to be at Asia.
Yeah, so Asian Services in Action, were better known as Asia for the acronym ASIA. We were founded 27 years ago as a nonprofit organization serving the limited English immigrant and refugee community. And more recently, about 8 years ago, we became a federally qualified health center so that we could provide primary care healthcare services to this population. And because we are a federally qualified health center, that means that we serve community members regardless of their ability to pay. And folks can pay as little as nothing on a sliding fee scale based on their income. So we have 9 different departments that are part of our organization. We have our adult aging department. We have our AHIMSA department. AHIMSA is a Sanskrit word for peace, nonviolence. So that is a code name that we use for our domestic violence, sexual assault, human trafficking department. We also have a community and civic engagement department, which is our advocacy as well as civic engagement arm of the organization. That's where we help people to help citizens register to vote and advocate for issues of importance to the community that we serve. We have a children, youth, and families department, which is our after-school homework help and more. You know, community members who arrive in the United States as children, there's a lot of adjustment that needs to happen. So we are there for their social and emotional well-being. Then we have our International Community Health Center, which, as I mentioned already, is a federally qualified health center. We have our Interpreting and Translation Services Department, which you would expect for an organization that serves the limited English proficient community. We are able to offer interpreting and translation in 55 different languages. Wow. 28 of those languages are spoken with fluency by our in-house team members. And then we work with freelance interpreters and translators for the 27 other languages if we don't happen to have a team member that speaks a particular language. Additionally, along those lines of talking about language access, 80% of our team, including myself, speaks at least one language other than English. And some of our team members speak as many as 5 different languages. Oh. Because of the country where they originated. And, some African countries, you speak 5 different languages, you know, automatically. Afghan community members, they speak 5 different languages just as part of their everyday communication. After that, we have our legal services department, which provides everything from visas to like immigration legal services with visas, citizenship, green cards. And within the legal services department, we also offer family law services and services for victims of crime. So assault, robbery, that sort of thing. We represent the victim. We bring the community member, if they're willing, to file a police report, and then we support them all the way through until they receive justice. So we go to court with them. And our lawyers are bilingual. You know, some of our lawyers are bilingual, and all of our advocates are bilingual, bilingual or multilingual. Then we have also, I forgot, our APEX Fund for Economic Opportunities. It is our financial literacy, financial empowerment, our space for those who wish to become small business owners. We are able to provide not only technical assistance in how to be an entrepreneur, but also financial assistance, because we're able to provide some small loans that the community members that we serve would otherwise be unable to access from a traditional bank. And the reason is because only in the United States do we have something known as a credit score. In other countries, there is no such thing as a credit score, even in Canada. So we have had customers, clients, patients from Canada, and you know, when we ask them, what's your credit score? What is that? Is there a response? So we have to educate the international community about so many things that are practices in the United States. And we hold their hand, throughout that process, so that any loan that they obtain from our Apex Fund for Economic Opportunities, it's a relationship loan. And we have never, God bless us, knocking on wood, we have never had a loan go into default where the customer was not able to repay the loan. If the customer encounters a situation where they feel like they might have difficulty making a payment, then we have discussions with them about a potential loan modification so that they can adjust the payment or adjust the term so that they can continue to be compliant with their obligations under the loan. I lost count of how many programs I have identified, but I guess the last one would be our sustainability services department, which is the longest standing part of our organization. It is our social services arm, where basically any need that you could think of, any need that someone might have as a community member, it is served under sustainability services. So if someone has food insecurity, we offer culturally specific food. Many people might not know that there are different types of rice that are consumed by different community members from the same continent. So like, you know, South Asians eat different rice than Chinese people. They eat different rice than Filipinos. They eat different rice than Thai community members. So we are able to offer culturally specific food that is different than a traditional food bank might offer. For example, if you go to a traditional food bank, they might provide peanut butter as a staple of the food that they provide in the food box. But many international community members, they ask, what is this? How would I use this? And so we have to be very culturally sensitive in our delivery of service and also in our approach to the services that we provide. So just keeping on with the sustainability services, that department also supports benefits access. So if someone needs assistance enrolling in, public insurance benefits or something like that, we have caseworkers who can assist them. We also have team members who are able to help with housing, with job searches. You know, if someone comes to us and says that they are looking for work, we're able to connect them to opportunities. I'm trying to think if there was anything else that I did not mention. We also have a farmer's market. In the summertime, we host a farmer's market, and it's because the international community, like it's kind of in our blood to have a garden. And unfortunately, when new arrivals come to this country, they don't often have their own backyard. Like sometimes they'll arrive and they will be living in an apartment. And when you live in an apartment, you don't typically have a backyard where you can grow your own vegetables and things like that. So we have partnered with a local farm that offers space for rent at a relatively reasonable cost. I think it's $80 for a summer plot, and you can, you know, grow your own Asian green vegetables. You can grow. I've seen community members grow corn, and which is shocking that corn can grow that fast in a growing season, and then whatever the surplus is, beyond what they need to feed their families, community members can sell it at our farmers market. So it's really a social enterprise where it's addressing, kind of a food desert situation and in the areas where we're serving in Akron. And on top of it, it's also a food desert of a different type, because there's a food desert where there isn't culturally specific. There aren't enough culturally specific access to groceries. And so through our this social enterprise, not only are they getting food because they need it, but also the surplus of the of what they farm, they're able to sell it at our farmers market. And I have seen a mother and daughter duo, and this was even during the pandemic, where they made like almost $300 for a few hours of selling at the farmers market. And obviously it takes longer than 3 hours to grow those vegetables that you're going to sell at the farmers market. But if I could make, you know, $300, 3 hours sitting at a farmers market vending booth, I mean, and spend time, you know, as a mother-daughter duo or something like that, like the family that I saw, I mean, that's a great way to enjoy good weather when we have it in the summer at our farmers market.
Yeah, all of those things, the depth and the breadth of services that you are providing to your community is amazing. And I'm sure that because you're in it, there are things that you may say, we need to do more, we need to do differently. But I just want to say, it's amazing. And the folks that are recipients of those services and those programs are so blessed and highly favored to be in community, not just receiving the things, but to be in community with an organization that's intentional as Asia. So thanks for that. So I want to talk a little bit more about your advocacy work, your advocacy, your civic engagement, your democracy building. So if you will, share a little bit about your work specifically and maybe what led you to your work at Asia.
Yeah, so I have been in a relationship with Asia since 2007, when I started volunteering. Initially I had volunteered with Asia to sort donations, because at that time, that's a long time ago. We accepted donations of, like, you know, clothes and things like that for the community members and the newly arrived community members. And now we do less of that, just because of different capacity reasons. But at that time I would sort donations. I'd sort, like, shoes into, I group all the shoes together that were the same size, and just kind of things like that. Things that helped me to relax as a very busy, at that time, new attorney. And, you know, which is a stressful job, right? It's a stressful job to be an attorney, and I needed an outlet. So one of my law professors, Professor Brant Lee at the University of Akron School of Law, he suggested that I connect with Asia if I was looking for a way to give back to the community. And that was initially how I connected with the organization. But then once they learned that I was an attorney, they said, "Oh, you're an attorney. Can you help us with this, that, and the other. And then it evolved from reviewing contracts for Asia to can you teach a Know Your Rights class on landlord-tenant law to, debtor-creditor responsibilities. And just kind of kept escalating. It just kept escalating until so much of my time was invested in Asia that a staff jokingly said, you should just work here. And so when my interest and the opportunity at Asia arose, it was aligned, and I applied for a position, and then here I am today. So, but even beyond that, my interest in supporting and giving back to the limited English proficient community, it's always been in, part of my ethos. My mom was an interpreter for pregnant women, and I always thought she wanted me to become a doctor, but I disappointed her and became a lawyer. But it was because, she and I still joke about it to this day. We still joke about how I didn't become a doctor, and all she wanted was not for me to become a doctor because all Asians have to be doctors, but more so because in order to have trust with a patient or have trust with the community, there are some commonalities or some familiarities that naturally enhance and build trust. And so my mom, she was never a doctor. She was able to provide assistance to pregnant women by being their interpreter and being their interface between, a doctor that did not speak the languages that my mom speaks and the pregnant women that did not speak English. And so she showed me firsthand how sometimes women suffer in silence about their women's health issues, and sometimes they're not heard when they raise issues about their physical health, and they're brushed off as being hyper reactive to something that they are truly experiencing. And so my mom wanted me to be that understanding and or familiar and or culturally aware person to interface with a community that already has some challenges from historical we might have to re-record this part. For community members who may have been overlooked in terms of expressing their medical issues and not being understood. So my mom always wanted me to be in that space, to be a connector with the limited English proficient community and the English speaking community, so that the needs of that limited English proficient community could be met in a culturally and linguistically focused way. And so I have always had in my mind, in all the work that I've ever done, what can we do to make sure that people are not overlooked simply because their language skills are different than someone who is born in America.
Yeah. I mean, you fulfilled your mother's wish you didn't even have to become a doctor, right?
Yeah. And, right. And she still jokes with me. I hope she's joking, but whenever I call her on the phone or we talk on the phone, she says, there's still time, Elaine, you're still young. You can still go to medical school. No, that ship has sailed. That ship has sailed. So.
So, yeah. We love you, Mom. But thank you for, you know, being vulnerable with us and telling us that and sharing that your approach, your methodology to your work is something that is centered in, you know, culture, right? So really being able to build relationships with folks and build trust to help them to navigate. So thinking about that as your approach or your methodology, can you share with us a challenge of maybe when that didn't work as well as you thought it would, and then a success story when it did?
That's an interesting and not easy to answer question. But maybe it's something that that I could share through a story. So like in 2020, when our civic engagement department was assisting community members with completing the census, there were enormous challenges in getting the community to complete their census. And why is a historical reason. It's the reason that many community members came to the United States as refugees. And it is because there are some countries where they take a census and they ask questions like, what is your religion? What is your, you know, what village are you from? You know, what, you know, things of that nature, where they group people into people who can stay in the country and people who get ousted from the country or ethnically cleansed out of a country. And so against that historical backdrop, we had to, you know, battle uphill, you know, fight uphill to convince the community members that in the United States, that doesn't happen. And, you know, you take the census and it's purely for a count so that resources can be appropriately allocated based on the number of people that would need those resources. And so it took enormous effort from the staff that speak the languages where that's a particular challenge to convince them that, you know, yes, we need to acknowledge the history that occurred in your country of origin. Yes, that happened. And you are in a different space now where the way that they handle your information is different. And the purpose that they are gathering the information is different. It is not to say that if you are part of a particular religion, and they don't even ask, you know, they might ask. I'm not sure if they ask on the census. But in other countries, they might ask what your religion is, and you know, that's not permissible here in the United States. And you can't even ask if you're a citizen here in the United States. And Asia was actually a party plaintiff to that class action suit to remove the citizenship question from the 2020 census. So we are very proud of having, so that's my, an achievement, something that I'm very, very proud of in the same story. So we fought that citizenship question and it was removed, thankfully. So it was not part of the 2020 census. And it is very important that the community continue to hear that the purpose of the census is not for any divisive reason, but it is for the for budgeting and for the appropriate allocation of resources to the community. So and even though 2030 is it seems like a long time away, it really isn't. And we're going to have another census in 2030. And hopefully these messages are uplifted in a way that community members continuously hear the please participate in the census. This is what it's about. And to have true and accurate counts so that community members get the representation that they need to be welcomed in this country.
I have just a quick follow-up question for you, Elaine.
Sure.
If you don't mind. So I'm from Arizona, where, you know, there are a lot of politicians who did want that citizenship question on there. For, you know, of course, the political rhetoric is that, well, you know, we have a lot of immigrants from Mexico, and they're not citizens, and they're, you know, whatever the political rhetoric is. But it seems to me that there's a deeper reason why we wouldn't want a citizenship question on the census. Why is it so important that that's a question that's left off of the census?
Because there are so many people who live in the United States, and they are, you know, documented to be eligible to be in the United States, and they simply have not yet completed the process to become a citizen. And so if all of the people who are legitimately in this country on a green card or a student visa for, you know, multiple years of their education, if all of those people were not accounted for in a decennial census, then my goodness, we would not have the appropriate number of resources to address the people that are living here. And a perfect example of shortages and things like that, that folks were not prepared for in 2020, was the pandemic. So in 2020, at the beginning, at the beginning of the pandemic in 2020, there were not sufficient safety, things like masks and things like, vaccines. There weren't even like gloves. There weren't even sufficient gloves for the community that needed to protect itself in the healthcare space. And why was that? That was because there wasn't a proper count of the people that needed to be protected and served based on a census. And when that happens, because it's for planning as well. And when and there are people who live in this country legitimately who are not citizens, because it's a process. Citizenship isn't a situation, or naturalization. Naturalization is unlike, being born in this country where you have automatic citizenship. But if you need to go through the process of naturalization, it does not happen in one appointment. So, there's so many steps to that process. So if it was a situation where the citizenship question was on the census, so many people who were in the middle of becoming a citizen, or maybe who have no intention of becoming a citizen and just want to live permanently as a legal resident, you know, on a green card, that's their choice. And for some, it is a kind of a question of nationalism that is a personal choice. You know, just because somebody might want to avoid death or harm in their country of origin, and so they escape to the United States, that doesn't mean that they don't love the country where they originated. It just means that circumstances arose that they needed to choose to live and seek refuge in the United States. So for all those reasons, having a citizenship question on something like the census is extremely harmful to everyone. You know, I mean, imagine if the number of vaccines that they produced for the country was based off of a very, very inaccurate count. And then, you know, like, you know, some, and I'm just kind of making this a ridiculous example, but imagine if there was only half as many vaccines available as was needed to safely vaccinate this country, and that you know, who would they choose? How would they choose to vaccinate you know, vaccinate only citizens. Okay, well, that's a pretty terrible thing when we walk among people who we don't know if they are a citizen or a non-citizen, and we share airspace with them, and we share community with them, and it is no one has more value as a human in terms of humanity, you know, because of a status like citizenship. So I, you know, there are all these reasons are reasons that having a citizenship question on something like the census is just completely unjust.
Thank you for that. I also want to hold a little bit of space in this conversation for, you know, we're talking about the questions of the census, but really and honestly thinking about the census in general and why people arrive in the United States as refugees. And I think it's important as we talk about race and democracy to hold this space for, you know, like you said, folks are fleeing for their lives, right? And for the longevity of their families. And I think it's important for us to talk about the role of the United States, right? The role of colonialism and imperialism in that. And so once they've arrived here and then, you know, the request is to fill out the census and you know, disclose all of this information, I think I just want to have that conversation with you. And I want to ask, how has Asia been able to have that conversation, right, with the communities that you are serving to really honor that and recognize that, you know, okay, you're here now and you're safe. These are air quotes for our listeners, but recognizing the role in perpetuating those unsafe conditions in the folks, in the places where folks are fleeing from, and also recognizing the role of colonialism, imperialism within the United States government. So how has Asia been able to navigate that?
Yeah, I mean, it's not easy. I mean, we're known as Asian Services in Action, and sometimes, you know, people misinterpret that name, which was a name that was penned at a time when most of the community members that we served were from Asian countries. But today, you know, we see immigrants and refugees from Africa, you know, from the Democratic Republic of the Congo, from Kenya, from Cameroon, all these different places where there might be challenges of survival if they stayed in their country of origin. And same thing for Ukraine. We are seeing trickles of new arrivals from Ukraine. And in addition to other Asian countries like Burma, Nepal, and Thailand. So there are a lot of reasons that you know, people come to this country, and Asia has to navigate educating the new arrival about expectations that exist in the United States, and while at the same time respecting the cultural practices and cultural beliefs of the variety of community members that we interact with and that we serve. So it's not an easy navigation.
Yeah, it sounds like walking a very fine line, navigating two difficult spaces. So moving on to navigating difficult spaces, one of the other things that happened in 2020 was this wave of anti-Asian racism. And it was, you know, definitely felt here in Northeast Ohio. How do you think that that's kind of impacted your work? And maybe it had always impacted your work, and it was just kind of brought to light for you know, the rest of us that hadn't been aware of it.
Yeah, I mean, I have known, unfortunately, about racism for my entire life. There's no way for me to pass as any other ethnicity, and so when there are people who for whatever reason hate people who look like me, then that is something that the community grapples with. I'm not old enough. I'm not old enough to have been aware of. I mean, I had heard about a story where a young Chinese man was beaten to death by two white out of work auto workers, like during that kind of auto worker problem where American auto workers thought that Japanese auto workers were taking away their jobs and their livelihoods and things like that, and impacting their economic status in this country. And so, unfortunately, there was a young man, his name is Vincent Chin, and he was beaten to death by those two out of work auto workers because they thought that he was Japanese. And he was Chinese, but he was Chinese, and you know, so racism against the Asian community, it's not something that's new. It's just, you know, what is the latest thing that somebody who is ignorant wants to blame on an entire community? And that is what happened in 2020, where you know, people are frustrated about the lockdowns, shutdowns, and things like that. So they looked for a community to blame for that situation. There isn't anything in Asian DNA that makes us more likely to be carriers of COVID or any other disease. You know, we are all humans, and we just, you know, happen to have some other characteristics that are, you know, part of being Asian. You know, I have black hair. Right. I you know, my skin is the color that it is. But I'm a human first. And, you know, I happen to be Asian. And it was a struggle for the community members to say, okay, you know, community members would say, okay, here we go again, get ready. They're blaming us for COVID. And it's not any different. And I'll just kind of share this story. So I was in conversation with one of our team members at Asia who happens to be a refugee. And he was sharing with me how he was, you know, his entire community was thrown out of their country because of their religion. And I said, wow, that I can't imagine. We were in conversations, and so I said to him, I can't imagine that that there would be this self-destruction of a country by either banishing a part of the country, or killing an annihilation of part of a community, which also happens in some of the other countries of origin. And I said out loud, I can't imagine that would happen in the United States. And then I paused and I said, wait, it did happen in the United States. You know, in World War II and other times, but the one that popped into my head as those words were coming out of my mouth, I was like, wait, in World War II, they rounded up everybody that looked like me and was suspected to be of Japanese origin. They rounded them all up and put them in internment camps, you know, where they lived for years in a space deprived of all their rights, even if they were American-born citizens. I mean, I just, you know, take a moment to for that to sink in, you know, that they rounded up their own citizens, put them in camps because they thought, you know, something, and it was pure racism. So the United States and other countries, you know, like no country is immune from racism and or other types of isms, you know, whether that is separating members of your country based on religion or ableism or you know, orientation, all those things, all those divisive and unjust reasons that you know, countries, you know, annihilate portions of their people. And so this is something that even Asians who live in the United States, we have experienced this before the wave of anti-Asian hatred and racism that spiked yet again in 2020. And I do want to underscore the fact that you know, whatever the numbers that reflect, you know, a 150% increase in those crimes against Asians, that number is woefully underreported. And I know this as a lawyer and as someone that works at Asian Services in Action. We on a regular basis, you know, when someone comes and they come to us and say, you know, what can I do? I've just been assaulted. Let's say I've just been assaulted, and then the first thing, you know, we ask about the circumstances, et cetera, et cetera, and then we recommend, hey, you know, would you like us to help you with a police? Take you to the police station and file a police report. And then the community member who is unfamiliar with things like police reports, they will say, what is a police report? And then we will tell them, okay, it's something, it's a form that you fill out. You put your name, your address. No, is how they immediately interject. What? You want me to put my address on this report? Then the person who attacked me, they will come to my house. And so they immediately shut down. And no matter what you say to them, they're like, I don't want to file a police report. And then I say, well, but if you don't report, you know, I might say to them, if they speak the same language that I do, I'll say, Auntie, if you don't file a police report, we can't do anything about what happened. We have to start with the police report. And their response is unwavering. No. If there is, I have to put my name, address, I don't want. I just want to move on and forget about it. And so so whatever data that's out there, I know from personal awareness that it is woefully underreported because most international community members, they do not want to be public about that type of information. And so what we do is when we realize that there's no way of convincing them to report, then we shift our approach and we say, okay, Auntie, you understand you don't want to file a police report. How can we support you? And then that's when they also shift and they say, can I talk to someone? I feel afraid after what happened, and I would like to feel better. And so that is the segue that we have, the opportunity that we have to introduce them to our counseling services, which we also offer as an organization as part of our International Community Health Center.
I also wonder if, you know, in many countries, I assume folks in your community may come from, the police aren't necessarily groups to be trusted.
Yes.
And I don't know that police in the U.S., well, no, I do know the police in the U.S. haven't shown themselves to be trustworthy either. Is there a reticence because of that as well?
There is. There's definitely a history of mistrust. Even from the international community, they do not view police as necessarily their friend, and that's also because you know, and it's the same thing in the United States. You know, police are an extension of the government, and for a lot of the international community members that we serve, government is what put them into the situation that they had to flee. And so, you know, and I won't say, you know, I definitely am not of the position that you know, police are not helpful. They can be, and I also don't think that we should lump all things together in a overgeneralized way. But we are definitely needing to work together with law enforcement, so that we all have a better understanding and expectations of one another. You know, we I think have different expectations of each other without knowing without knowing it. So without each other knowing it. And I think that if we had, you know, true understanding through communication and through a dialogue, we would be in a better place than we are currently in this country. Gun violence is another issue that it has impacted all communities of color. And this past week, you know, it was supposed to be a very happy time for the community, because Lunar New Year had started on last Saturday. And I was so happy, like quite literally, I was so happy on Saturday, January 21st, because there was a celebration in the community. And every time I hear the drum beat of the traditional lion dance, it's like a heartbeat for me. I feel alive. And so I went home on Saturday and woke up on Sunday to you know, a enormous tragedy in, you know, for the Asian community. And even here in Ohio, there was a shooting in an Asian grocery store near Cincinnati, and it is just really hard to smile and celebrate what's supposed to be a joyful time when tragedies are happening. I hope that that something will be done in this country to address gun violence.
Yes, I definitely agree that something has to be done to address gun violence and, you know, all violence. Yeah. Right. We could keep going. Violence. We could expand that. But especially
right. gun violence. So.
Absolutely. So here's just a quick note for the producer is I want to ask this question, but then I'm going to drop off because I have another meeting that I have to go to.
No, thank you so much, Shamar. You're fantastic. This conversation has felt so natural because of the questions.
Oh, thank you. And so the last question that I want to ask, and I'm sad that I won't be able to hear the response now, but I'll definitely tune in for the podcast. But so you share with us some of the barriers, right, that exist systemically to getting the community and the folks that you serve the things that they need. So now I just want to ask you, from your perspective, from the perspective of your organization, your personal perspective, feel free to, you know, differentiate between the two if they're different. What are the opportunities for systemic co-conspiratorship? So how can other organizations and institutions meet you where you say, right? So leading from your own community, these are the things that we say that we need. How can organizations and institutions show up in that space to co-conspire for the liberation of your people?
That is an amazing question. And I'm sorry that you have to drop off, but I guess I'll start by saying that showing up for each other is probably the first step in co-conspiratorship. I'll tell you that I was moved personally in March of 2021. When the first in the pandemic mass shooting occurred in the Asian community, and our partners across every group of color came out to show support when we marched. We had a unity march in DC, and then we also had a march locally in our local Asia town, and community members from every spectrum came out to support us and be there for us. And that is I think the first step towards working towards the goal of liberating our people, and then believe it or not, I love this Maya Angelou quote that we are more alike than we are not alike, and once we are able to see beyond the superficial things where we are not alike. I think that it will move us so much closer to true collaboration in achieving our collective goals. As one example, so I was in DC very, very recently, like I said, to announce the Lunar New Year at the White House. And While I was there, I saw a news stream going on in the waiting area, and the news stream referenced how the governor DeSantis in Florida was banning African American or AP African American history from their school system, and I thought, this is absolutely ridiculous. You know, what are you worried about, Governor DeSantis, that you're going to ban access to knowledge about the history of, you know, African Americans in this country? That is absolutely ridiculous. And it applies, similarly to Asian American studies as well. You know, we shouldn't have to wait until we're in college and we're looking at some classes that address Asian American history, both the contributions as well as the struggles, and that goes for all communities of color, and that there shouldn't be a censorship of that truth. And so So this is just one point of intersection where I hope that all communities of color will lock arms in true collaboration to advance a position for completely inclusive US history. Because the Black experience, the Native experience, the Asian experience, we have all we all have history in the United States, and that should be part of U.S. history.
Yeah.
So glad I was here for it.
Me too.
Yes, yes, yes. Okay, I do have to jump off now, but thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Thanks. See you soon, Casey.
Bye.
Yeah, so that goes along with what I said right. about truly complete U.S. history includes the Asian experience, the Black experience, and the Native experience. So anyways.
You mentioning the Japanese internment camps, where I grew up, there was actually a Japanese internment camp that had been placed on Native land. And yeah. I was looking through it, and so many of them had been yes. placed on Native land. And it was like, yes. wow, you really did that. You really did yes. that. You took land you forced people to go to, mm-hmm. and then you confiscated it to force more people. It
yes. just,
you know, but they didn't teach that in school.
Right.
So it's just like their little, I don't know, dirty little secret.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
All right, last real question. I'm going to write this down. So last question, we normally ask people at this time to share words of wisdom, but we also don't normally have people that have been to the White House. So words of wisdom, and also tell us, how do you get to the White House?
Oh my gosh. I mean, I'm very lucky. I am extremely lucky that I had the opportunity to announce Lunar New Year, or the first ever Lunar New Year at the White House. And I'm also extremely grateful. So I think that my words of wisdom would be, you know, never miss an opportunity to do good. And when you have those opportunities to do good, be grateful for the opportunity.
I love it. Thank you so much. And I'm sure your mom was very proud about that.
Yes, my mom was very, you know, I've got mom credit. I've got mom credit for a while. Like I'm good. I'm good. If I mess something up with my mom, I've got credit now.
Yeah. You roll it forward a few years, right?
Yes.
Thank you so much for joining us, Elaine. It was a real pleasure having you on.
Yeah. Thank you so much for, again, this opportunity. And, you know, I hope that there will be other chances where we might uplift some of the work that Asia is doing. And, you know, this is just the first of many.
Absolutely.